Welcome to American Family Focus on Pennsylvania Issues, a weekly program discussing issues of concern to the family and those who hold traditional family values in Pennsylvania and our nation. Archives of these programs can be heard at www.afafpa.org. And now, your host, Diane Gramley, State Director of American Family Association of Pennsylvania. Article 2, Section 2 of the United States Constitution gives to the President the power to nominate, by and with the advice and consent of the Senate, ambassadors, other public ministers and consuls, judges of the Supreme Court, and all other officers of the United States whose appointments are not laid out in the Constitution. Let's face it, the average American doesn't know what's in the Constitution, although that is thankfully changing. The news doesn't talk much about judicial nominations or nominations in general, unless it's for the Supreme Court. But this is almost an ongoing process during a president's four-year term. As concerned citizens, we need to better understand the impact all these nominations have on our lives and how the process works, the good, the bad, and the sometimes ugly aspects of it. To help us better understand the process, my guest today is Kurt Levy. He is the executive director of the Committee for Justice. Thanks, Kurt, for being with us.
Thanks for having me on, Diane.
And we'll start with the basics. What is the Committee for Justice?
Well, the Committee for Justice was originally set up to deal with the Democrats' filibusters and other obstruction of Bush's judicial nominees, and our mission has since grown to involve other constitutional issues, but all related to promoting the rule of law and fighting judicial activism. The truth is, the best way to fight judicial activism is to put judges who believe in the rule of law on the federal courts. And so that's what we try to do during a Republican administration and during a Democratic administration. We hope we can at least limit the damage.
And you mentioned filibuster. So your organization first came into existence during all that controversy about the filibuster, where the Democrats were almost continually filibustering President Bush's nominees. Now, what is a filibuster, and is what the Democrats were doing back then, was that unprecedented?
Well, it was unprecedented. And again, a filibuster, well, people think of it from, you know, Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, where one senator stays up all night just saying anything he can to prevent a vote. Of course, now what it amounts to is that instead of 50 votes to proceed, you need 60 of the 100, or I should say instead of 51, you need 60 of the 100 votes to proceed. You know, at some point, the Democrats had 60 through about half of Obama's first 2 years, which makes it almost comical when they complain that Republicans were blocking judicial nominations and other things. But in any case, while filibusters have always been used to one degree or another on legislation, using them to block a judicial nominee was unprecedented until Bush. The Democrats did it consistently, blocked almost, you know, 10 nominees that way, including Miguel Estrada, who they specifically were worried about because he was Hispanic. They were worried that he would become the first Hispanic Supreme Court justice if they let him get on the D.C. Circuit. Of course, Sotomayor has now taken that place. The Republicans have not rolled over on judges under Obama, but they have not used the filibuster. They used it once.
Right. So back to Miguel Estrada. They were afraid, the Democrats were afraid that a Republican was going to nominate the first Hispanic Supreme
Court justice. It was early in Bush's presidency, mm-hmm. and the D.C. Circuit, if ever there's a gateway to the Supreme Court, it's the D.C. Circuit, D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals. And they thought, and perhaps rightfully, that if Estrada did a good job in the D.C. Circuit, he would then be nominated by Bush to be on the Supreme Court. That's certainly where Thomas and Scalia mm-hmm. came from. That's where Bork almost came from, had he been confirmed to the Supreme Court. And there are memos that were accidentally disclosed by the Democrats that showed outside groups saying to the Democrats, you've got to block this guy. We don't want him on the Supreme Court because we don't want him to be the first Hispanic.
And talking about, you mentioned Judge Bork. So that whole process there was not a filibuster. He was just demonized.
Yes, he was just demonized. There still hasn't really been a filibuster of a Supreme Court nominee. I mean, some people debate what happened with Abe Fortas in the late 60s. I won't bore your listeners with the details, but he didn't have majority support. So you really don't need a filibuster when you don't have majority support. You can just let the floor vote occur and the first person will be voted down. And that is what happened with Bork.
Now, I'm going to refer to November 29th, 2008 Wall Street Journal article entitled Obama, Judges in the Senate. And that article states, quote, in picking judges, one test will be how Mr. Obama uses the American Bar Association, the lawyers group hoping to reclaim a dominant role in judicial vetting. It lost that privilege during the Bush administration when the president noted ABA's supposedly nonpartisan professional review had devolved into transparent politicking. Let's start with the first question. What is the American Bar Association?
Well, the American Bar Association is a large professional organization of lawyers, the largest in the country, but it's not necessarily representative of the average lawyer. It's very, very liberal to the extent that it does things like, you know, provide retirement savings for lawyers. I don't think anyone objects, but it takes a lot of political positions, and those tend to be very, very liberal, pro-diversity, pro-judicial activism. And they've had a role for a long time in the nomination of judges. Typically, nominees would be screened by the ABA before they were even announced. Bush changed that so that the ABA didn't have a pre-screening role. They still did an evaluation once the person was nominated, and that was an influential evaluation, but they weren't, in a sense, involved in the nomination process per se, more the confirmation process after the nomination. And of course, the ABA screamed, you know, this is our job, and why would you doubt us?
Right.
And I think that was a positive, reducing their role. But of course, one of the first things Obama did when he got in office was to restore the ABA to its old role. And I don't think it's a good idea for the ABA to pre-screen nominees, not even just because of their ideological bias. I wouldn't want the Federalist Society doing it either. I just don't think an activist group should have that sort of role. Once someone's nominated, anyone can weigh in. And if the ABA wants to have a special role by doing a more thorough investigation than anyone else, I suppose that's their right. But why any one activist group should have a special screening role before the person's even nominated, I just don't see a reason for it.
I don't either. The Constitution doesn't mention anything about any other organization.
It
says advice and consent of the Senate, period. It doesn't say any type of organization has the right to weigh in. So basically what the American Bar Association does is it pre-screens potential nominees, and then the president draws from that pool? Is that what?
Not quite, although what you're describing does happen on the state level, and there's problems with that as well, if you want to talk about it. What happens on the federal level is the president will say to the ABA, I intend to nominate this person.
Okay.
In effect, does he meet your standards?
Okay, so the president gives the ABA the name of someone he's considering, and they do the checking and give him an excellent or good or poor rating, basically.
Yes, exactly.
Okay. And you say that also happens on the state level?
Well, on the state level, states pick judges in, you know, basically three different ways. Sometimes they're elected.
Yeah, okay.
Sometimes they're just straight out appointed by the governor the way that, the president does. And sometimes they're appointed by a hybrid method in which a committee picks a few people, typically three, and the governor then has to pick one of those. The problem is the committee is made up typically of ABA folks or, you know, the state bar, really, and they have a liberal bias, and typically they'll pick three liberal people, and the governor has to pick one of those.
One of the three liberals.
Yeah.
Seems like that happened in Iowa. Seems like that happened recently.
You know, it was originally considered a reform. Iowa had two issues. It had the fact that three Supreme Court justices were recalled for finding constitutional right to gay marriage, but then they also had the battle over the method of selection. And a lot of states have had that battle. It was considered, when it was first done decades ago, it was considered a reform. And in theory, it could be. If the committee was really objective, it could take some of the politics out of it. The problem is the committee immediately gets captured by the state bar, which has, as I say, invariably a liberal bias.
Yeah, here in PA, we elect our judges, but there has been, especially when Governor Rendell was in office, there was an effort, or he kept talking about the need for merit selection. And I'm assuming that's one of the things you're talking about, where the governor chooses, something like the president does now, the government, or rather the governor nominates an individual for a certain judicial position, and then he's confirmed, this individual is confirmed by the Senate.
Not if Rendell meant merit selection the way it's normally used. Merit selection is normally a euphemism for that hybrid method.
Oh,
and again,
okay.
that's worked to put make state Supreme Courts more liberal.
Not surprised. Not a good idea.
Democratic governor would want it, and but not a good idea.
Right, not a good idea. That's what I figured. If he's pushing it, it's not a good idea. That's just my thought.
Now, good instincts.
Yeah. Now, referring back to the November 29th, 2008 Wall Street Journal article, it also says then-Senator Barack Obama, you know, prior to his election in November 2008, he suggested on the campaign trail that one of his criteria for selecting judges would be their empathy. Is that a good criteria to use when looking for someone to be a judge on any level?
No, it's not. For the first thing, it's usually, again, empathy is a euphemism for judicial activism, i.e. don't follow the rule of law, but go with your feelings about who should win and what the Constitution should say. But, you know, even if you took ideology out of it, just, you know, put yourself as a litigant in a courtroom or worse yet, a criminal defendant, and imagine if the judge were to say, you know, I feel a lot of empathy for the other party. How would that make you feel? Would it make you feel like you were going to get a fair shake? Of course not.
No, right. It just basically goes along with his feelings, how he feels towards the defendant.
Yeah, at best, it's the antithesis of the rule of law. It's the rule of men, based on how the particular judge is feeling at the moment. And at worst, it's nothing more than a veneer for judicial activism.
And there was one, and I cannot remember the guy's name, but there was one, he was from Massachusetts, I think, one of the New England states, that I don't know if Obama actually nominated him or was, I think he was actually nominated. But this judge, when he was in Massachusetts, one of the rulings he handed down was just so outrageous. It was a murder case. And again,
I think you're thinking of Shatney.
Right. And definitely he was a very empathetic fellow, but I would not want him as a judge in Massachusetts, let alone on the federal level.
Well, empathetic to the murderer,
to
the victim. And of course, that's the whole trick with empathy. You can feel empathy towards whoever you want. I mean, you can, it basically, as I said, is the rule of men, because at the end of the day, it's all about the judge's feelings. I mean, maybe one judge feels empathy for an unborn baby, and another judge feels empathy for a pregnant woman who wants to have an abortion. Another judge feels empathy for the murderer. Another one feels empathy for the victim. I mean, it's completely arbitrary.
So basically, when it comes to a president, he gets to choose whoever he wants for these positions. If they meet, you know, they have the education such as that, and they're able to do the job.
Well, I mean, you know, not even. I think, you know, certainly in my lifetime, I can't remember a non-lawyer being picked, but the Constitution doesn't even say you have to be a lawyer. So you can really pick whoever you want. I mean, at some point, if the person was so unqualified, I think even your own party would object. Mm-hmm. But in effect, you can pick whoever you want. And sometimes, never done 100% on merit. Obviously, it has a lot to do with political connections, and I guess that's true of all appointments. You're never going to completely remove that, but at least the person should be qualified, somebody who I think not only has the education and experience, but also has a little bit of track record in how they interpret the Constitution. Mm-hmm. You know, when you don't have that, we wind up with situations where Republicans put people on the Supreme Court, especially, who wind up being judicial activists. We've seen that, you know, in the last 50 years several times with, you know, Souter and Warren and Brennan. Those were all Republican appointees to the Supreme Court.
That's not good. So what were those individuals who became Supreme Court judges, justices, had no track record as a judge? Is that what you're saying? Had no real track record?
Well, Brennan was on the New Jersey Supreme Court. I mean, Warren was a governor, so yes, and Souter was for a little while on the federal court, but not long enough to really judge him.
Okay.
The problem there more was just a matter of focus. If you're not focused on, if you're just focused on, you know, did this person go to a good law school and how long have they been on the bench? If you don't ask the right questions and really scrutinize their record, you wind up with a situation where you really don't know what the guy thinks about the interpretation of the Constitution. Mm-hmm. Now, again, a president's not required to do that scrutiny, but I think given what's happened in the past, it's certainly wise.
Oh, absolutely. because we've definitely suffered from judicial activism and is becoming more rampant, I believe. Have there been any major changes, I guess, in the way that a president chooses a judicial nominee or the quality of the nominee? Looking at the last 200 years, what major changes have you seen in the nomination process?
Well,
not that you're 200 years old, but I mean, you're looking over the history. What changes have you seen?
Well, I think everyone agrees that it's become a lot more politicized since Bork. I mean, it was always political with a little p in the sense that connections mattered, but it wasn't this huge ideological war, an attempt to really win the culture war through judicial appointments. That really started with Bork. You know, it was in a sense so uncontroversial that it's really only in the last 50 years or so that Supreme Court nominees have hearings, no less week-long hearings that are televised to the nation. That level of scrutiny, it really only started with Bork. And as I say, even the idea of having hearings is relatively new. So it's certainly become a much more visible, much more politicized. And in a sense, that's because of judicial activism. If the Supreme Court and other courts are going to be deciding all the big social issues of the day, then it really is worth having a huge campaign fight over who's nominated. If judges were serving a more modest role and were just doing their job and interpreting the law and not making law, then it wouldn't be worth investing such a huge amount of resources and energy into these battles.
Right. So even the idea of a hearing is a new concept because of the increased judicial activism that we were seeing.
Yeah, as I say, relatively new. It started, I think, in the 50s.
Okay. And as we see the role of judges change, how can we get it back on course? Because as you're mentioning, judicial activism and the increased role of judges in some cases, legislating from the bench. Can we, or what can we as common citizens do to reclaim or reset the path that this whole thing is headed down?
Well, I think educate yourself about what judicial activism is. Don't overuse the term. Every decision you don't like isn't necessarily judicial activism. If it's the Constitution is not 100% clear on everything, so judges have some discretion in interpreting things. But when they start making things up, like a right to abortion or a right to gay marriage, which we're starting to see and may get from the Supreme Court in the next year, that is judicial activism. And people have to show outrage. I mean, like everything in our political system, politicians will get away with it if people don't show outrage. It's very hard to police it just through the nominations process. I mean, you're going to have liberal governors and presidents. We talked about three different methods of appointment at the state level. They all have problems, although I think merit selection is the worst. So you're not going to be able to do it totally through nomination. In some sense, you have to shame them into it. And I think we've had a little bit of success in that area. Certainly, if you've been watching the confirmation hearings up until about 10 years ago, liberal judges openly talked about the living Constitution. Mm-hmm. They don't do that anymore. They deny any belief in it, and they say, of course, we will rule just based on the four corners of the law. Now, do I really believe that they will do that? No. But I believe that when you're embarrassed about something, you do less of it than when you're not embarrassed. And I do think we've seen the liberal justices, judges on the lower court, state judges, I think we've seen them be a little more shy about judicial activism. But certainly the threat has receded only a little bit. And like many things with liberalism, you can slow down the damage, but it's hard to reverse.
Yeah, it's hard to reverse. That's quite true.
As we've seen with Roe v. Wade, I mean, the really telling thing is that while liberals are screaming about the current court being conservative judicial activists, what conservative judicial activism would really mean is, say, finding in the Constitution a prohibition against abortion. Not striking down Roe v. Wade, which would leave it up to the states. Mm-hmm. That wouldn't be judicial activism at all. That would be reversing liberal judicial activism. But if they were to say that the Constitution forbids abortion such that no state can decide to allow abortion. Now, I know as a matter of policy, a lot of your listeners would like to see that, but that's not explicitly in the Constitution. If the Supreme Court were to say that it was, that might be conservative judicial activism. But I don't know any conservative who even, any conservative judge who would even think of finding that in the Constitution. So I think that just tells you that conservative judicial activism is nowhere near what the liberals have done, if it even exists.
Right. I agree, because it's usually the liberals, like the judges in Iowa, who found the right to gay marriage in that state, and three of them lost their jobs over that. But usually it is the liberals who are reading in between the lines or making things up when it comes to interpreting laws. And I agree. I can't think of any instance right off the top of my head where there's been conservative judicial activism, and they stick to the Constitution. And as you're saying with Roe v. Wade, there's not, the Constitution does not deal with that issue.
Right. It simply does not deal with it.
Right. And it needs to go back to the way it was and leave it up to the states to decide on the abortion issue. Get rid of Roe v. Wade, throw that out, and leave it up to the states, even as it was prior to Roe v. Wade.
Exactly. Exactly. But, you know, for whatever reason, liberals are all about control. They don't like the idea that some states will enact laws that they might not like. So they will give up Roe v. Wade kicking and screaming. I mean, if you think we're going to have big battles about gay marriage, can you imagine? They've now gotten so used to having this right to abortion that I just can't imagine what the fight would be like. And right now, we don't even have five justices on the Supreme Court who would vote to overturn Roe or even seriously weaken it. So right now, it's just a hypothetical. But if that day came, I just can't imagine the conflagration you would see as liberals tried to hang on to Roe v. Wade.
I can't either. Now, right now, in the U.S. House, there are eight House Republicans who are staying in session, basically, to block President Obama from making recess appointments. And with him staying there, keeping the House in session, it prevents Obama from unilaterally making new appointments to federal agencies. And that can only be done when both the House and Senate are in a recess. So what are these eight Republicans doing exactly, and what is a recess appointment?
Well, recess appointments probably were necessary when the Constitution was drafted, because Congress only met for a few months a year, and you might not want a position to go empty for, you know, say, the remaining 9 months. So it allowed for the president to temporarily appoint someone to fill that position. And, you know, that's really no longer necessary. Congress, for better or probably worse, is never far away. But it remains in the Constitution, and it's been used very sparingly, but it has been abused a little bit by Obama in terms of both judicial appointments and executive appointments, to take someone who just can't get confirmed by the Senate for good reason and put them in there for a year, year and a half, basically till, I won't bore your listeners with the details, but if you appointed someone now, they can basically serve till the end of the current 112th Congress. But again, that can only happen when Congress is in recess. Senate can't recess unless the House recesses, so if you keep the House from recessing, you, in effect, prevent this problem from happening.
Yeah. Now, if we have a situation where there's a bad nominee who's up for confirmation, they're having the hearings before the Senate, what is the most effective thing that an average citizen can do to block this nominee or to have their voices heard?
Well, you know, again, that's something where they can usually be shamed into it. The reason that recess appointments work is because they typically don't get a lot of coverage in the media. It's not something they're proud of, presidents are proud of, because they know they're, if not bypassing the letter of the Constitution, the spirit of the Constitution. And so if you basically get the word out there, call the White House and complain, call, you know, Congress, because, you know, if senators of the president's party were to say, we don't really like being bypassed, that can have a tremendous effect. But again, the most important thing is raise the visibility of it so that a president doesn't try it or, you know, doesn't push it once he's proposed it.
Okay, so, and if there's a bad nominee up, we need to let our senators know our views on that individual who's up for the, you know, up for
yes, but it can be somewhat bipartisan in the sense that even the members of the president's party may not be too crazy about the idea that the president is, in a sense, usurping the Senate's role.
Yeah. Now, if folks wanted more information about the Committee for Justice or wanted to contact you guys, how could they best do that?
Well, I would say the best is go to our website, committeeforjustice.org. You can learn about our battles to fight judicial activism, about our battles to stop the worst of Obama's nominees, and in general, just about our efforts to promote the rule of law.
Okay, committeeforjustice.org, and I encourage folks to check that out because we need to become better educated on this process and how it works and, you know, how we can have input into it.
We sure do, which is why it was made me laugh or cry when the Democrats objected to reading the Constitution.
Oh yeah, I know that was. Oh yeah, that was crazy.
Yeah, our problem is not that people know too much about the Constitution.
No, that's not the problem.
Too little.
That's true. Okay, thanks, Kurt, for being with us, and again, committeeforjustice.org. Thanks, and take care.
Thanks so much, Diane.
You have been listening to American Family Focus on Pennsylvania Issues. If you would like to get involved in defending traditional values in Pennsylvania, please contact the AFAFPA at Post Office Box 1048, Franklin, 16323, or visit their website at afafpa.org. The views expressed on this program do not necessarily reflect the views of American Family Radio, Lighthouse Ministries of Franklin, AFA, and AFAFPA.